Katie, what have you for us today?
I wanted to talk about Orson Welles.
Good.
I watched Citizen Kane for the first time at 50 years old last week, and I'm so glad that I waited to see it because now that I have my mediological perspective on things, it was fascinating. I thought about Marshall being Orson's contemporary and wondered whether he was interested in Orson and found out that he was. He wrote about him just one paragraph in Understanding Media, but some articles that I found reported that Eric McLuhan knew that Marshall was really interested in Orson, and one scholar wrote a book about him, and then I found a really good article, too. So let's just start with what Marshall said about Orson in Understanding Media. This is on page 35 in the chapter called The Voice and the Eye. It fits right in with the mashup that you just played of the words.
What did you just say? The chapter called The Voice and the Eye?
I'm looking at the wrong book. I'm looking at The Medium and the Magician. No. This is right. This is in Understanding Media. At the top of the page, on page 35, I might have the wrong book. This is quoting from Understanding Media, though. This is Marshall.
What's the name of the book?
This book, it's Marshall's book is Understanding Media. This book is called The Medium and the Magician.
And who's that by?
That is by, it's by Paul Heyer.
Oh, yeah. I know him. Now, this is a book about Orson Welles.
Correct.
And this is the quote from McLuhan. You're going to read a quote from McLuhan that's in the book on Orson Welles.
Correct. And this is the only place that Marshall wrote about Orson. He was interested in him and talked about him. And two scholars that I read about this, Paul Heyer, and then he wrote the book, and then I also found a journal article that he wrote in the Canadian Journal of Communication. So I have some of his ideas about what he thought, picking up on knowing that Marshall was interested in Orson by talking to Eric.
Right. Go ahead, then.
Okay.
Let's hear it, yeah.
So this is the only place that Marshall talked about Orson. And they were only 4 years apart, so they were contemporaries. So I would have thought that Marshall would have been fascinated by him, and evidently he was. Okay.
And he did write in other places. He did write about Orson Welles in other places.
Oh, he did?
Not so well known. Yeah.
I didn't. Well, you would know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, you can talk about that.
Yeah, you would know.
Okay. All right. The subliminal depths of radio are charged with the resonating echoes of tribal horns and antique drums. This is inherent in the very nature of this medium, with its power to turn the psyche and society into a single echo chamber. The famous Orson Welles broadcast about the invasion from Mars was a simple demonstration of this all-inclusive, completely involving scope of the auditory image of radio. It was Hitler who gave the radio Orson Welles treatment for real. So that's what we'll open with.
Okay, so the content of the electric medium of radio is speech. So it retrieves this awareness, which I just played.
The acoustic world with its magical power over the being of things.
The acoustic world with its magical power over the being of things.
Acoustic world with its magical power over the being of things.
Now, that is what ION started off teaching the 99%ers, the little people, the power of your voice, how you can make reality, right, with your voice. That is traditional, pre-littered, very pre-littered tribal awareness. As Ted Carpenter is explaining this, a great associate of Marshall McLuhan, he even claims he wrote parts of Understanding Media, and he says he has the papers to prove it, but he died a couple of years ago, so we'll have to wait till his papers are released. He ran the art world after he left McLuhan in the 70s and 80s, New York art world, because he married a Demoniel, who were the main funders of the art scene of the 60s and on, starting with Andy Warhol. All those artists you heard about were funded by Ted Carpenter's in-laws. Okay, so Ion's Word.
Acoustic world with its magical power over the being of things.
So here's Ted Carpenter, who, as an anthropologist, studied Eskimos, what were called Eskimos back then in the 50s and 40s, brought a great awareness of tactility and the preliterate awareness of the word, the power of the word, to McLuhan. McLuhan had read some anthropology, but Ted Carpenter, you know, really provides some expertise. And this here is Ted Carpenter saying what Ion says, you know, 40 years before.
Acoustic world with its magical power over the being of things.
Isn't that, it's a very poetic way of talking about the power of the word, the magical power over the being of things. So that's the content of the radio environment, because the radio environment is electric simultaneity, which speech can't do. Speech can't be simultaneous over the whole globe. It has to be inside an electric medium. So the content of speech, which leads to the drama of Orson Welles and the invasion from Mars and then acted out by Hitler, all because of the simultaneous effect. So, okay, so you want to read what McLuhan said again?
Okay, sure.
You heard it.
Sure, I've put my glasses back on. Okay. The subliminal depths of radio are charged with the resonating echoes of tribal horns and antique drums.
Let me interrupt there. Hold it. So the subliminal depths, that's the tactile depths, has content, the retrieval of tribal horns and echoes and drums. Okay, that's the rearview mirror. That's the content. Visual space doesn't have a prayer against the radio. The visual empires of the British and the American, the Anglo-American semi-Illuminati establishment are hopeless before radio and World War II. It began with the electric effects in World War I, where the oligarchy was knocked out, the Austro-Hungarian branch. But so you have this power of Hitler able to use the megaphone, public address system, to create a fantasy world, an acoustic world, of thanks to the power of his voice. Not going to last long because electric simultaneity will underdo anybody. He just can't be content for very long. So, next sentence.
The next sentence. This is inherent in the very nature of this medium, with its power to turn psyche and society into a single echo chamber.
Yes. Now let's listen to this. Ted Carpenter, a little later, describing the single echo chamber.
Before writing, all of these divisions merged into a single knowledge, a single rhythm, in which all was present, now, sort of an eternal now.
See, it's common in pre-literate societies to have no sense of sequential linear time, eternal now, eternal memory. And so that is what Zappa called the big note, the single rhythm. Looking for the big note, which was tribal preliterate awareness.
Before writing, all of these divisions merged into a single knowledge, a single rhythm, of which all was present, now, sort of an eternal now.
A single rhythm. And jazz came in as the content of the radio environment in the 20s, 30s to unite the world under a single style of music, not just a rhythm. So the big note would be what a simple acoustic society would want to do, would want to resonate around. You know, when there is thunder, the natives apparently would say, what did he say that time? So they regarded the thunder as the voice of some single note, some single rhythm. Okay, the next sentence.
The famous Orson Welles broadcast about the invasion from Mars was a simple demonstration of this all-inclusive, completely involving scope of the auditory image of radio.
All-inclusive?
Yes.
Yeah, all-inclusive. There's the beginning of the global membrane. The global village.
Completely involving scope. It's an all-inclusive, completely.
Please.
The famous Orson Welles broadcast about the invasion from Mars was a simple demonstration of this all-inclusive, completely involving scope of the auditory image of radio.
Yes, the auditory image. The visual image is the global village, and that's what they called internationalism in the 30s and 40s. not so much in the 50s. TV changed that, but it became a, it was a rearview mirror for many decades, and that's the conspiracy, the New World Order. People are still worried about a world government running the global village. When it moved into a global theater with the satellite and television, and then a global membrane with the internet. But he's talking about the global membrane. It's beginning there in the radio era as an all-inclusive, what was it, resonating membrane? What was the phrase?
It's an all-inclusive, completely involving scope of the auditory image of radio.
What's the sentence before all-inclusive, or the few words before that?
He's talking about the panic.
Just saying the words before all-inclusive.
Was a simple demonstration of this all-inclusive, completely involving scope.
S-C-O-P-E.
Correct.
S-C-O-P-E, scope.
Correct.
Simple demonstration, all involving. Okay, that's the beginning of the global membrane, which we have under internet conditions. Let's see. Now, what's interesting about the internet is you can disconnect anytime you want from the all involving. So that's the tyranny of the analog electric space coming in with radio and TV. Okay, so the next...
Well, you guys, is that the all-at-once-ness, or
yes.
Is that bringing time into it, too, and not the just the auditory?
That's bringing space in and time, and time and space are both obsolete. That's why Einstein, in a rearview mirror action, had to turn time and space into a sculptural zone beyond the Newtonian absolutes. So Einstein did the rearview mirrorage of updating visual space by bringing in acoustic all-inclusiveness. In other words, a space-time continuum, which bent, which wasn't absolute, which was relative. You see?
Mm-hmm.
You get that?
Yeah.
So, and the content of the radio is all geographies, all spaces. Wherever the broadcast is coming from is the content. But that geography that the broadcast is coming from is spread over a timeless and spaceless, marginless dimension.
Yeah, because you can't say it's just where it's coming from, isn't it? Where it's going to?
No, it's not going anywhere. It's just everybody is tuned into it. When you turn on the radio, you don't go anywhere. You just enter a space. You cancel millions of years of evolution, all the evolution of nature and dinosaurs to human. But when you add a new organism, what Desjardins called a biological event. Right?
The event.
Yeah, a biological event is electric space. So so how would you write that in a book? How would you present that?
Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, you would present all languages and spaces and times as much as possible on each page. That's the immediate image, immediate visual image of the auditory effect, or what he calls the auditory image. So what's the next sentence, Katie?
It was Hitler who gave radio Orson Welles' treatment for real.
Right. So you have Ion talking about non-physical being everywhere, instantly in touch with everybody. That is the astral version of what happens under electricity. So that's why Ion comes in to move us past the image of non-physical that traditionally people or the elites or the esotericists or the occultists had. That's why Ion could now merge with the physical. He's moving out of the timeless and the spaceless, which was the normal domain of non-physical, into a new kind of space. The cloud, right. The cloud. A techno version of what radio... So radio replayed non-physical. That's why you had the obsession with the occult, you know, in the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, with symbolized by Yeats and Theosophy and Krishnamurti and yoga and mysticism. All those things that were marketed to teenagers in the 60s and 70s were replayed from the 20s, sold through Maharishi, Mahesh Yogi, and the rest of them in the 70s and 80s, was a nostalgia for kids. It was very involving for adults, like E.M. Forster's novel A Passage to India is symptomatic of that trend in the 20s. So you look at the effects in culture and books and movies and television and science and sports, the changes caused by radio. So this you're quoting from a chapter called The Voice and the Ear by Paul Heyer.
The Voice and the Eye.
Mm-hmm. Voice and the Eye
voice
by
and
Paul
the eye.
Which is a replay of McLuhan's Eye-Ear. the voice mm-hmm. in the eye, he's redoing McLuhan. Okay, next.
But at least he starts with the voice.
Rather than the eye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. But he doesn't point out that's the content of radio. You won't see many McLuhan scholars pointing out the simultaneous effect. The radio has no content. The devastating effect of radio is a simultaneous membrane that everybody is put inside of, canceling millions of years of terrestrial evolution. Think of that. In 1 second, mm-hmm. as soon as the radio environment was incorporated, whenever that happened, 1922, whenever radio started coming in.
Yeah, and I forgot that it canceled geography, too. Everybody's... Where do people think they are? Inside the radio, in
they
their home,
they
in their
think
head?
They're in their home listening to something being broadcast at them because they're only hearing the content, your speech. And the speech says, we're from New York City, and we're playing jazz from the Roseland Ballroom tonight. You know, all that obsolescent language, no matter what culture it is, of spatial and locations and temporal and tempo. Not where it is. You have actually been invaded and usurped. Therefore, the resonance of Orson Welles' Invasion from Mars, that's an approximate content panicky situation to explain that you as a biological species have been obsolesced by a new invading species. That's the closest you can get to show that a Darwinian evolution is gone, if you want to dramatize it in chemical body terms, right?
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. A new insight for you, Carolyn, there, eh? The percept of no time, no space. Only Joyce seemed to get this, and maybe Ezra Pound, he was trying to show this with cantos, and maybe Eliot with his four quartets. And Wyndham Lewis definitely got it in his book, The Childer Mass, 1928, where he satirized Finnegan's Wake. So Joyce.
But Katie, does Orson Welles seem to have an understanding of what Joyce and McLuhan had about what he was doing there?
Mm-hmm. He does. I don't know if he would attribute it to Joyce and McLuhan, and Joyce was a little older than him, so Joyce would have been very young when Ulysses was published for sure. Because I was kind of trying to think too, because there was a lot. I don't know if people know this. I didn't know it, but there was a huge fight between William Randall Hearst and Orson Welles over the publication or the viewing of Citizen Kane. It was really similar to the Ulysses book burning. Hearst tried to get all of the copies of Citizen Kane and had it burned before it was ever released because it was about him. So where I'm going to go with this conversation is you want to look
before
at,
you go, Katie, before you go, you said that Joyce was very young. Orson Welles was very young.
Orson
when was
he
very
born? Young.
19,
yeah.
17 or 18?
He was 15. Born... In, let's see, Orson was born in 1915, and Marshall
right.
was born in 1911.
Right, so Orson Welles is 7 years old when Ulysses comes out. That's why you're saying Welles is young.
Right. And I don't know when The Wake came out. I don't know, because I'm in the Ulysses.
Oh, The Wake came out in 1939.
Okay.
And so year after... Orson Welles and Mars Invasion. But you got to realize, Carolyn, he's only 23 when he does this amazing event
right.
on the radio. He's only 23 years old.
Right.
So he created it when he was 22.
Yeah, yeah. And it was based on him being a director of the Mercury Theater. He was already a pretty successful, I don't know if he wrote plays, but he was very involved in something called, called the Mercury Theater. That might have been radio drama.
No, that was theater, and what he was expert at was at adapting classical plays and putting them in a new way. So he would do Shakespeare and set it in Haiti and
yeah,
call it like
contemporary terms. In contemporary terms.
Yeah, and take it and just take it and put it in a completely different setting. And do it with, like, all black actors. So he did Macbeth is what it was and used
right.
all black actors and set it in Haiti, and they called it his voodoo Macbeth.
Okay,
and I'm not
so your next point, are you going to read from Higher? Your next point is going to be from Higher?
I will, but I do want to say where I'm going with this, and then my next point will be from Higher. Like, the first thing that I thought when I watched Citizen Kane and realized that this was an intentional fight between somebody who was an expert at having media sense around radio and then movies, over newspaper. So if you look at it from a mediological standpoint, remember when you told me that Marshall wanted to write a play where all of the media would come to life and interact? You have the radio on stage, you have the newspaper on stage, you have a book on stage. And well, this whole thing really signifies a fight between the pictures and the newspapers. And it's embodied through Orson.
Well, the radio, the acoustic and the visual newspaper. Acoustic
Correct.
Radio.
And Orson took him on purpose. Like, he hated him. He had been out to San Simeon, where Hearst entertained all of Hollywood, and thought that he was a hypocrite, and chose to try to go after him and malign him through the making of Citizen Kane. And then later, Hearst went after him through the newspaper. And Orson's career never really, he didn't do much after Citizen Kane. And
well, he tried to do Magnificent Ambersons, which was another suppressed, I think that was the name of it. That was another suppressed movie, caused a big problem, which was he was tackling the same situation, I guess, the oligarchy.
Well, a lot of it was because of Hearst, because he had dirt on everyone. There's a movie called RKO 182. I watched it. It's really good, and it's about this fight between the two of them. And there's a point where Hedda, this publicist, goes to see Hearst, and he's got pictures of everybody having sex with boys, having sex with little girls, having sex with black people, which was really frowned upon back then, plus the fact that everyone in Hollywood was Jewish. And he was going to ruin all of the studio heads because he had dirt on them all.
Yeah.
And he had the power to do that because he had the paper. So this built over time, and that's kind of where I'm going with it. But we can go back to Paul's article, because he did say some good things about Marshall's media sons, is what he called it.
Yeah, so, I just want to add, the fight that Hearst had first was with Pulitzer. Hearst and Pulitzer, two newspaper magnates, had a big battle for, I guess, newspaper power, and that might even be shown at the beginning of the movie Citizen Kane. And
a little bit.
And the Pulitzer Prize is sort of well known. I don't know if there's a Hearst Prize for journalistic excellence. So Pulitzer won the PR game on the name.
No, because he wasn't an excellent journalist. He was the National Enquirer. Hearst. He loved sensation, but even lie.
Right.
So there was a journalistic prize because he had no journalistic integrity. And he bought away all of Pulitzer's staff. He did everything with his money.
Right, and so Pulitzer gets the prestige today because the prize is named after him. I don't know where it happened to the Pulitzer wealth or their estate, but and then Hearst ends up getting his daughter or granddaughter, I don't know which it is, kidnapped.
Patty Hearst. It's the granddaughter, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Granddaughter. Okay, so let's hear what are you going to read from Paul?
Yeah, okay, so we're going to talk about what Paul has to say about Orson. So he talked about him having what Paul calls media sense. I don't know if that's like a media theory term that he coined, but it's a scholarly article, so we'll assume that it is.
Is and what? I missed your point. What's the term?
Media sense. Orson has media sense. Media sense. S-E-N-S-E.
And that's what Paul says.
Right.
Okay.
He says that Orson always sought the most effective way of adapting a narrative given the constraints and possibilities of his chosen medium. And then he goes on to describe how, like, in one scene, he has to show someone being beheaded through sound. So he used some sliding metal and then a cleaver chopping something on a chopping board and then a cabbage falling into a basket. He was an expert at creating, you know how you said live from the whatever hotel, we're going to have jazz tonight. He was able to really make people feel like they were being transported in the play. In an adaptation of Les Mis, he was able to recreate them running through the sewer in a way that no one else ever had. So he wasn't literal, and he never used the voice of a narrator to say, now we're going to be in the sewers of Paris. He would just take the person there through sound. So that was what made him so genius. His media sense led him to eliminate some characters and speeches in plays, change the order of others, and reposition the actors given the constraints of the microphone. He thereby made the recording more than a literal and inevitable limited transcription of the stage version. It's a media production complete unto itself. So he was very much like we adapt novels and plays to film now. He was able to do that with radio, which is what got him the attention of Hollywood.
Right, right.
At such a very young age.
And so where was he doing that? What was that called? What program was that?
This was when he had the Mercury Theater. And then he would do all sorts of other just voiceover work to have enough money to pour into his Mercury Theater, but that was his love.
So what are you saying he did? He did sound stuff in theater?
Mm-hmm. Like he was the voice of the shadow, or he would just go be an announcer, often anonymously. He was a voiceover artist.
Okay, so what did he do in the Mercury Theater that was innovative? What did you just read?
That was how he adapted plays, like Les Miserables. He did.
And he would put in sound effects? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
On the radio or in theater?
No, in theater, visual theater.
Hmm. No, it was on the radio.
It was on the radio.
Yeah, it was on the radio.
What did he do in theater, visual theater? Isn't that where he came from?
Yeah, well, he did his Buddha Macbeth. He did Julius Caesar. He did Dr. Faustus.
He was about 20 years old?
Well, he was 23 by the time he got to Hollywood, so he had to be a late teenager. He was quoted in several places that I read and watched about him as saying that, and this is important too, from the moment that he could hear, he was told that he was wonderful and there was nothing that he couldn't do and that he was a genius, and he just believed it.
Who told him that?
Everyone, starting with his father, but everyone around him told him how great he was.
So he does these plays in a normal New York theater and is a director in his late teens.
Correct.
Yeah, he's like Phil Spector with the Motown or the Wall of Sound and the girl groups in the early 20s. So Spector was really young in rock and roll. So then he has a radio show called the Mercury Theater.
Yeah, it's called the Mercury Theater on Air.
And he innovated sound effects that no one else thought of doing?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so he hadn't done much of Mercury Theater, let's say 21 and 22, when he did the big invasion from Mars in 38. He hadn't done much. He did it pretty quickly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he goes to Hollywood right after that?
Yeah. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting when they talked about why the War of the Worlds broadcast was so effective was his use of silence. I guess there was like a 6-minute pause at one point, and that was unheard of. Everybody was a nervous wreck that he was holding it so long. And also that it induced so much panic in people. This reminded me of Finnegan's Wake, because the way people listened to the radio then, there were different programs that were on, and one would start, and then it would get to a point where they'd go to a break and play music, and then people would start to turn the dial. And it was when they turned the dial from the news program that had cut to music that they came in kind of to the middle, or not the middle, but maybe like a fourth of the way through, of Orson's War of the Worlds broadcast. So they missed all of the things that he said at the beginning that indicated that it was just a regular play. So, and then if you talk about media logic again, which Ion talked about last week, and we haven't done any processing about that, so I'm not sure for sure what Ion meant, but like from a scholarly.
You mean media ecology? I hear Ion say media ecology all the time.
No, he talked about, he said media logical.
Okay.
So So if you take mediological and take that back to what would be the noun for that adverb, it's mediologic. And mediologic in communication theory is how certain things seem so normal to you in terms of the use of a media that you don't question it. And that fits in with the whole conversation about you can't hear a word until you've heard it before and you wouldn't see the Nina Pinta in Santa Maria if you couldn't see it, that whole thing about how we can't sense something until we know it's there.
Okay, that applies
so the
to me.
Why,
could you read the last paragraph you read describing Wells's whatever you were describing? Just repeat that paragraph you had already read.
I
think it was about what he did.
What was I saying?
Maybe about his effects on Mercury Theater.
Oh, his media sense.
Yeah,
it was about his media sense. Yeah, Wells was able to do this because he had something that could be called media sense. In other words, he always sought the most effective way of adapting a narrative given the constraints and possibilities of his chosen medium.
Which is radio? Radio?
Well, it was radio, and then it was film after that.
Okay,
and it was
so
plays for that. So he could do it with whatever he wanted to do it with. He was first recognized as a genius for radio, and I personally think that was his best.
Okay, so what's the next words?
Okay.
Sort of repeat slightly what you said.
Okay, Wells was able to do this because he had something called media sense. In other words, he always thought the most effective way of adapting a narrative given the constraints and possibilities of his chosen medium. When he made his first film, Citizen Kane, his initial concern was not to be overly preoccupied with what other filmmakers had done, but to understand the resources available to him at RKO and determine how he could best harness them for his own storytelling purposes. This ability
Could you read that last couple sentences again?
Mm-hmm. When he made his first film, Citizen Kane, his initial concern was not to be overly preoccupied with what other filmmakers had done, but to understand the resources available to him at RKO and determine how he could best harness them for his own storytelling purposes. This ability enabled him to achieve fame in a greater variety of the performing arts than perhaps any artist of the past century, and to achieve infamy in radio 65 years ago.
So he was interested in the technical effects more than, did you say, the storyline or something else?
He wanted to make sure that he didn't just rotely tell a story, but that he used all the different media and adapted the story.
So he understood
that
the linear part was minor in the radio experience. The visual space was minor. It was the well of loneliness is a phrase the radio environment created, and he wanted to massage that. He wanted to sculpt the dangling nerves of the listener, the extended central nervous system.
That's really actually quite a beautiful way to put it, sculpt the dangling nerves of the listener.
Yeah, and he knew narrative was not as important.
Wasn't it the dangling ganglia?
Yes, it was, Carolyn. We've changed it now, though. Thank you for
I like
the
dangling ganglia, though, because they're very
we all do, but
carry on, I'm out of pants.
I've said it many times. I thought I'd do it differently. So that's what he's doing. He wants to create these sculpture effects on radio. That's more important. And because that's right. In his movie, he was innovative to the max. Everything he did was innovative. I mean, was new. It blew people away what he did with the Citizen Kane movie. But we're talking about...
It blew me away.
Right. Now, are you going to go back and talk more about the invasion, or he's just talking about him as a filmmaker?
He actually talks more about the radio part. Paul does. He doesn't talk much about
the
media
next sentence?
At all.
What's the next sentence?
We don't want to go to the next sentence.
You haven't. That's all you read before.
Yeah, and then there's a big discussion about what I had just briefly talked to you about him earning credit for his radio performances and having full creative control over his own projects and, like, how his career grew, how he did Les Mis. We've already kind of covered that, so I don't think you want the next sentence. I think you want me to turn some pages and keep going. And let's get to the Mars Attack.
Yeah, when you say Les Mis, you mean Les Miserables?
Yeah, he did that on the radio. He did A Tale of Two Cities. He did Les Mis. He did Dracula. He was really praised for his sound effects and his Dracula performance. He used howling wolves, creaking carriages, and recreated all the sounds within the castle.
Now, you say Les Mis. Is that a popular way of saying Les Miserables? Les Mis?
Yeah, that's why most people don't ever say Les Miserables. They just say Les Mis.
Yeah, that's the 90s or 2000. The people who watched it in New York recently, right? They say Les Mis.
Oh, I've said Les Mis since the 80s, but whatever.
Yeah, since it was around.
So the next part? Now I'm talking about when he did Dracula. He was praised for doing it far differently than Bram Stoker did. And here Paul's going to quote Beauregard and McLuhan, so I'll read this, okay?
Yeah.
Two weeks after Wells did Dracula, he broadcast...
Who are you quoting first? I'm quoting
Paul, and he's going to talk about McLuhan and Jean Beauregard coming up.
Oh, okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Two weeks after Wells did Dracula, he broadcast A Tale of Two Cities and evoked the sound of the guillotine. This is what I had mentioned before. And evoked the sound of the guillotine by using a sliding metal door followed by a meat cleaver slicing a cabbage, which then dropped into a wicker basket. Such auditory conjecturing relates to McLuhan's discussion of media representations as reference points for our sense of the real.
That's Paul saying media representations of the sense of the real, right?
Right.
That's Paul. See, there's really bad language. There's no representation in electric space. That's visual. So this is academic nonsense that just, covers up the percept of what McLuhan's talking about. And they use the word real, doesn't fit. So I'm objecting to Paul's words, but you read what he said.
Okay. Despite what some postmodernist theorists might contend, this is not an idea recently discovered by Jean Beauregard. Okay, so now you comment on that then. Correct it.
Yeah, I did. Well, he's
well,
not
just
presenting
said it was
what,
bad, but you didn't correct
yeah,
it.
Yeah, he's misinterpreting Beauregard. He doesn't even understand Beauregard. But the read. I won't say anything for a while. Read. Maybe start again
okay. And
read what you're saying. Yeah.
Well, I don't think I need to read that again.
No, we do. We repeat. This is radio.
Can we read again? Okay.
No, understand. Now listen to this. This is what you do in radio. You repeat. You go into depth. Literate man doesn't want repetition. The literate, visually biased people listening now are just, grimacing because they don't want to hear things said again, but they don't understand that you only get the surface meaning when you read and look at things. But when you repeat things acoustically, it's done differently. It's in depth. As McLuhan used to say, he repeated because that was a depth way of exploring. So it's okay we're repeating things.
All right. The sound effects in Wells' Dracula, and I'm just going to comment here, it is amazing, too, that he put on these radio plays week after week after week, to get Les Mis done, then Dracula and A Tale of Two Cities, that's a lot harder than the TV shows that we see now in terms of production. That's amazing to me.
Okay, yeah.
The sound effects in Wells' Dracula are exceptionally well done, howling wolves, creaking carriages, and the resonant castle. Wells knew that a sound effect had to be convincing in terms of the listener's expectations. What is literally accurate might not seem real to the radio audience. This, again, is another example of his media sense. It's also an aspect of semiotic theory. The signifier does not have to be a perfect representation of the signified, only close enough to suggest it in the imagination of the viewer, reader, or in this case, listener. 2 weeks after Wells did Dracula, he broadcast A Tale of Two Cities and evoked the sound of the guillotine by using a sliding metal door followed by a meat cleaver slicing a cabbage, which then dropped into a wicker basket. Such auditory conjecturing relates to McLuhan's discussion of media representations as reference points for our sense of the real. Despite what some postmodernist theorists might contend, this is not an idea recently discovered by Jean Beauregard. So he's saying that Beauregard didn't discover it.
It doesn't make any sense at all. He's just giving examples of Orson Welles did to create sounds. It's nothing to do with signifier or signified.
Or simulation, yeah. He's a literate guy putting literate ideas, which is the tone of academia in the 80s and 90s. They went all visual because they couldn't handle McLuhan's tactility, so they retrieved visual space in a complex way.
Dragging in Baudrillard as if it means something, and it just obfuscates the whole position.
He's a literate chick in the mud. Up there in McGill or someplace. I think he's at McGill, Canadian thinker. Guess who his teacher was?
He's at Wilfrid Laurier. He's at Laurier.
Yeah. Guess who's if I got this
Thiel?
Right. Don Thiel is his teacher.
Oh, my gosh.
And now, while Katie was watching Kane and looking into this week, I was reading Don Thiel's interpretation of Citizen Kane this week in the unpublished manuscript, The Ecology of Sense.
And I think it's totally amazing, Katie, that you're bringing up quotes that then Bob can relate to with what he was reading and talking to me about this weekend.
Yes, I'm going to read you what Thiel says about Citizen Kane. So when you told me the other day,
really,
I got stuff right here.
Oh, that's so amazing.
Yeah, when you told me you wanted to do Citizen Kane the other day, I didn't say anything to you. I said, oh, perfect, because I was just reading about Citizen Kane that day.
Oh, my gosh.
Right, which is normal.
Right,
you work with me. Synchronicity happens all the time. But let's hear what Thiel's student says first. You know what I mean? So far, he's not too cool.
Right.
So you can pick another good paragraph or whatever. We're not knocking what you would read. What you want to read.
And I kind of get what he's saying. I mean, he's saying it wasn't a head falling into a basket. Like, he could use a cabbage. It's a stretch, but I get what he's saying. So let's think what else. So he just goes on and on about the panic broadcast and how everybody was crazy over it and this and that and the other thing. So let's read this. Enter Marshall McLuhan in 1964. As alluded to earlier, he was fascinated by the panic broadcast and what it revealed about the nature of radio.
It's so silly. Unless he's just saying enter McLuhan commenting on Welles in 1964. But, you know, McLuhan was doing his media analysis for 10 years. But maybe he means a Welles comment. Okay, so he starts off saying,
I think he does, but at the same time, if you have private stuff that no one has seen, and in the academic stuff that's available on the internet, it states that the only place that Marshall wrote about Orson was in Understanding Media, that one paragraph that we read and repeated a couple of times.
Right.
I can see how people left it at that. I knew there was no way that was it. I mean, we're coming up on a year now that you and I have been having these conversations, and when I saw Citizen Kane, I was like, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad that I didn't see this a moment before. I would have missed the whole thing. I would have just thought that it was a story about a sled.
Right.
But to see it with all this media ecology background, there's no way Marshall wasn't looking at this. No way. And they're just going to do that in academia because that's what they do. So Enro Marshall McLuhan in 1964, as alluded to earlier, he was fascinated by the panic broadcast and what it revealed about the nature of radio. In Understanding Media, he observes how Welles used the auditory involving power of radio to tap primal fears and emotions, anticipating what Hitler was about to do in reality. He also perceived Welles' approach as one that recognized how the subliminal depths are charged with the resonating echoes of tribal horns and antique drums, serving as an echo chamber for the evocation of long-forgotten chords. Welles' many radio plays, especially the aforementioned Dracula, provide ample evidence for such observation. That McLuhan would be interested in Welles makes perfect sense.
I just want to say, before you do that, you said long-forgotten chords were heard?
Yes, chords. Like,
is that what McLuhan wrote, or
PH?
Is this what Heyer is saying, Paul saying?
Well, it's in quotes, so Paul seems to be quoting Marshall.
Long forgotten chords.
Yes.
That's like the big note. Zappa's big note. Okay.
So that's page 200. That's on page 264 in Understanding Media.
Okay.
Long forgotten chords. okay, if we want to look that up later. That McLuhan would be interested in Wells makes perfect sense, although we have no idea how familiar Wells was Canadian media guru's ideas. Just as McLuhan, a polymath intellectual...
He's saying we have no idea how familiar Wells was to McLuhan's ideas?
Yeah.
Is that what he just said?
That's what he just said.
McLuhan was teaching in St. Louis in 1938. Well, how could Wells know about McLuhan in 1938?
Well, I don't know. They were contemporaries.
But that's what he's implying. He's not saying we don't know how much Wells knew McLuhan in 1964. He's saying we don't know how much he knew in the 30s of McLuhan.
Right.
Wow, what a crazy statement that is.
I wouldn't even limit that to
Let's hear it. Read it again.
McLuhan would be interested in Wells makes perfect sense, although we have no idea how familiar Wells was with the Canadian media guru's ideas. I mean, if he's calling him a media guru, he wasn't a media guru until he
67, 68. So you're saying... So he's wondering if Wells, but it's irrelevant to wonder when Wells became aware of McLuhan in the 60s. I mean, we're talking about what he did in the 30s and 40s.
Correct. Right.
And Theo's going to address this in a minute, I think. So
I can't wait. I'm so excited.
Yeah,
okay.
The next sentence.
Just as McLuhan, a polymath.
And that's not a sucking up statement by Katie. She knows Theo's good. And every one of you out there should be saying, I can't wait to hear what Theo says. You know? It's not Katie being silly, just for the naysayers.
No, I love Theo. I've read shit ton of Theo.
Yeah.
Let's see. Just as McLuhan, a polymath intellectual and acclaimed oracle of the electronic media, understood media perhaps better than any intellectual of the 20th century, so the multi-talented Wells seemed to grasp better than any of his contemporaries how the properties of various media could be used to further artistic ends. In McLuhan's case, his scholarly media sense yielded insights into communication culture that continue to inspire both academic researchers and artists working in a variety of disciplines. With respect to Wells, his reputation as one of the 20th century's most important and influential artists seems to grow with each passing year.
And that's the end of his commentary on Wells?
No, he gives a little bit more on why War of the Worlds broadcast was so devastatingly effective, which I can tell you those reasons if you'd like, or you can comment on the paragraph we just read before I move on. It's up to you.
Well, I'm going to let me read a little Theo, and then we'll hear the next part you were going to read. So we'll start interweaving Theo here. Okay. Now, Theo emphasizes the people McLuhan got his insights from. The artists, the vorticists, all the great guys. And so Theo will call them the early 20th century artists. So here's Theo talking about the newspaper or the press played a role as an image in the various arts of the early 20th century. That's in Dadaism, Surrealism, and Picasso. And this gave impetus to the more severe criticism and satire of recent artists. So he's talking about and this is written maybe in the early 80s. So he's talking about pop art in the 60s, 70s artists. But they're a replay of Joyce and these guys in the teens. For example, Joyce's linguistic play and the theory and praxis behind it become essential as a stage in the development of the ways that writers such as William Burroughs, we did last week, Kurt Vonnegut, Samuel Beckett, the playwright, Waiting for Godot, or any number of science fiction writers such as Aldous, Philip K. Dick or Bruner can now begin to probe satirically the same kinds of material. So the 60s writers are redoing what Joyce and others were doing in the 20s, and they do it more viciously. Okay, in a parallel way, the historical movement from Kurt Switters, he was a famous Dada collage artist. In a parallel way, the historical movement from Switter's obsession, by which he made scraps of newspaper print part of the collage-like realization of the modern city, or from Picasso's use of the press as contributing to the fragmentation which resulted in the anti-fascistic destructive energy of his famous painting Guernica, to the more recent pop artists who have reabsorbed the press into their art. So spanning from the 20s and 60s to the, there is a significant progress in forcing an intellectual reconsideration of the prepackaged phrases, images, and modes of presentation of the press. Now that's Hearst. From this joint mm-hmm. perspective, it should not be surprising that the new wave of French film, leading to Godard and ultimately to filmmakers like Makhachev, who people don't really know, began with an Orson Welles film about William Randolph Hearst. So a lot of the avant-garde filmmakers of the 1560s coming out of France and other places in Europe, they were called New Wave, were seriously influenced by Citizen Kane. A film which in its unfolding action employs dialectical games playing off the cinematic newsreel against the daily press. So movies versus the press and I guess radio in there. Though it's interesting, mm-hmm. is radio an invisible environment, and that's what's seducing everybody in 1938. And the movie he makes is about movie versus press and how much is the radio in Citizen Kane. Is there much radio broadcasting in Citizen Kane?
No.
Or the movie newsreel. Yeah, okay. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
That in a way, I'm saying this, the radio is invisible in its effects even to Hearst. Because he's talking about recent media, cinematic newsreel versus the newspaper. So anyway.
Mm-hmm. But also if Orson Welles is doing an oeuvre. He did the radio with the aliens, and then he did the movie with Hirsch.
Right, and Finnegan's Wake predicts that the radio hots up the patriarchy. I mean, movies brings in Big Father on the screen. So patriarchy was re-embellished and reinforced in the 20s and 30s with the movie screen. So you would have a big patriarchal figure like Hearst. That's what that would be a figure resonant with the medium of film.
Yeah, and he inflamed mm-hmm. the guy so much that Orson
yeah.
Welles got swatted down. He had his license taken away.
Yeah, he got Dr. Dean.
He got moved
he
to Maui.
He moved to Maui. He got moved to L.A. and Utopia.
He got deemed.
He got, as Leroy Jones, the famous black beatnik poet of the 60s, told me, he was deported to the Bronx from Manhattan. He got deported. I no longer live in Manhattan, able to live. So you have the incredible impact of Citizen Kane on all the great inspiring movies that inspired the baby boomers, 30 years later, 25 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So Don's mm-hmm. laying out this
well,
important
excuse
history.
Me, this business about them taking up the Citizen Kane movie in France, that's part of their cultural revolution where they were against the capitalists?
No, that's 68. New wave cinema begins in the late 50s, early 60s.
Well, that could have been, things start 20
years. Oh, yeah. Godard and these guys were very influential on the baby boomers who did the riots in 68, in May 68. So here's another point. Since radio is simultaneous and brings in group mind, your drama must be to swallow the group. So you have an alien group come and swallow up humanity. That's an appropriate mm-hmm. content for radio. But because there's a visual literate aspect to movies, that's why you would figure a man, not the downfall of a species that the radio broadcast implied, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the subject mm-hmm. fits each medium here in McLuhan terms.
Mm-hmm.
So Don Thiel writes, Orson Welles produced Citizen Kane shortly after Joyce had completed Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Wake gets published in 39, but it was pretty well completed in 38. And you have Welles responding in a way to Finnegan's Wake subliminally, even though the title wasn't known in 38, but it was much printed in magazines.
Yeah, it was serialized.
In very obscure journals in Europe, and maybe a smart Orson Welles might have known what Joyce was doing. It was called Work in Progress, but I guess we don't know about that. But the point is that he's picking up the effects of radio, and he's going to show it. And Joyce is trying to show the effects of radio and TV in Finnegan's Wake. So Joyce is a bit ahead of Citizen Kane. But Kane is only 22 years old. Okay.
Right.
What?
I just said right, which is amazing.
Yeah. Right. So Thiel says, though it is difficult to imagine two works which would seem more fundamentally different, in other words, they are very different, Wells' career and his film are important in understanding what the evolution of art and media have to do with the relation between literary theory and communication theory. So even though these works are very different, they are intertwined with the same concerns about literary theory, communication theory, and the evolution of art and media. That's what Joyce is working on in Finney's Wake. Perhaps far too seldom do we consider together his two greatest early achievements, the radio broadcast called The Invasion from Mars and the film Citizen Kane. So what does this mean? Far too seldom do we consider together. Oh, we don't. Okay, so we're talking about it together, but Thiel is saying people don't put together the radio broadcast with the film. I guess like Paul Heyer, his own student, is not really relating the two.
Right. Why they don't see the mediaecology McLuhan aspect that that Bob and Katie see.
Yeah, that Bob and Katie, fine students of Bob, are learning.
Thank God someone sees it, right?
Yeah. Now Paul might object and say, no, he means that, but the fact that there's no radio in Citizen Kane should be the main headline in any discussion of Citizen Kane. But why? How could he miss that? Why didn't? It's like they were even Wells. They were different worlds. They don't see the synesthesia of the media started interpenetrating, which is what's shown in Finney's Wake in the 30s.
Or Orson Welles planned it that way. He wanted to highlight the next media.
Well, it wasn't. Movies was the previous media.
True.
Before.
Well, plus he had a lot of pressure. He had a lot of pressure because he had that panic broadcast and immediately was whisked to Hollywood and given a two-picture deal and really, really struggled and couldn't write anything. And he was given the most important contract in the history of Hollywood, not so much monetarily, but control-wise. He was given carte blanche. They were going to ask no questions.
Right.
He was considered such a genius. That had never happened
before. And
what
did he make? Is that when he made The Third Man? Or what did he make?
When he made Citizen Kane. But he struggled to come up with something to write. And he went to San Simeon, which was the Hearst castle, and hung out with Hearst, and Hearst offended him. And then Paul Mankiewicz hung out there all the time with the Hearst. Randolph had that mistress, Marion Davies, that he lived with openly, even though he was married to someone else.
Yeah.
And there was all sorts of stuff going on, and Mankiewicz had access to all of that information. So he actually wrote the first screenplay. He was a drunk, and Orson let him have a drink a day, and he wrote the screenplay. And then Orson took it and cleaned it up, and then took his name off and kept it for himself.
All right, I'm saying, who took his name off?
Orson kind of stole the play from Mankiewicz, didn't give him credit. And then they made up after
the play. You mean the play for Citizen Kane?
The screenplay for Citizen Kane, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what year did Citizen Kane come out? 40? Let's get the date. 1940?
I think it was 41.
Okay,
so
maybe I mix this up. Orson Welles produced Citizen Kane shortly after Joyce had completed Finney's Wake. He made the broadcast. Okay, so I'm thinking of 1938. I mix that up. I put the broadcast in with Joyce finishing the Wake in 38. Citizen Kane is a couple years after the Wake, and the Wake is happening the same time as the invasion from Mars. Okay, just want to clarify what I said there.
Citizen Kane was 41. Orson was 26 and Marshall was 30 when that movie came out.
Right. Yes. And so, do you want to say one more sentence or something before I say something?
No. That's
what
okay.
were you going
that's
to?
What I was gonna say.
You're just telling about how he swept off to Hollywood and then he made Citizen Kane.
Yeah. Also, how did he make the movie? Yeah, he almost blew the whole contract.
No, but he didn't. He did a great movie. Or did the movie get bad reviews?
Right. No, that wasn't what he set out to do. He tried to do several other things, and then suddenly Citizen Kane was like his last gasp at making this contract work.
Oh, so he made a couple other movies before Citizen Kane.
So he tried to. He would get the screenplays together and then show them to all the producers, and they would say, no, you can't do that. He just worked on things. That wasn't his first idea.
So he gets a contract in 38, 39, and he doesn't produce anything for 2 years till 41.
Correct.
And that's
and everybody's
changed.
Almost ready to pull the plug, and then suddenly he comes up with Citizen Kane.
And was it popular?
Well, Hearst found out about it from a rough cut.
Oh, yeah. So then he tried to suppress it, so he had a headache about that. And then
right.
he gets it out. What is the reaction to it?
The critics loved it. It was immediately critically acclaimed as one of the best movies of all time. It had a hard
yeah.
time in the box office at first, but because Hearst owned all of the newspapers,
oh,
and he
I
refused
see.
To advertise it anywhere. And then he threatened everybody with... you know, telling all the horrible people that they had sex with and all the scandals. So he, and I guess the Jewish thing, again, was like a huge, that was like a big deal in, it was the Depression, and
yeah.
people still didn't consider Jewish people to be, like, true American citizens. And so everybody was all pissed off saying, why are you giving all the Jewish people jobs?
Right. Okay, okay.
Americans
so, and World War One, World War II is going to start in a few months after Citizen Kane, so...
Right.
So does he make another movie after Citizen Kane? What's the effect on his career?
Yeah, well, his career was in the toilet because Hearst did make him out to be a communist. He wasn't, like, officially blacklisted, but he crushed him.
Yeah, but that's the late 40s. What happened in 41, 42, 43 to
Kane? What was that one movie that you mentioned? He made like three other movies. Yeah, that one and two others, which I don't know. But he struggled. He didn't do well. And he got big and fat and turned into the Orson Welles that died of a heart attack in 1985.
Right. Okay, is the Third Man, Third Man is one of the movies he makes?
I think. I don't know. I don't know much after.
Okay, so maybe we'll look that up in a minute. So, here's what Thiel writes. In the late 30s, Orson Welles was the genuine child of the new media world. Verbally literate, traditionally trained, and yet highly sensitive to the interplay between the media and to the power of words as well as images. It has become a commonplace to recognize Orson Welles' Citizen Kane as one of the major contributions to the history of film and to observe that Welles had a profound influence on French directors and film criticism of the late 40s and early 50s. So he's in trouble in the late 40s, but he's having a big influence in Europe. André Bazin speaks of Welles' innovativeness and his greatness as an artist, and even Godard, Jean-Luc Godard, attributes to Welles a key role in the formation of his own style as filmmaker. Yet, the young Welles was more than just a director. He was a man with a peculiar sensitivity to the variety of media, which were assuming an entirely new importance in the history of society. So, Carolyn, you might be partly right about he knew how to separate the media. You know, he knew and emphasized one in the movie and another in the invasion. Did you want to say something, Katie?
Well, not only did he write and direct, but he starred in it, too. And started as, in the movie, he's a very young man in the beginning. He was great with makeup. They put wires on his face to make him look even younger than he was in the beginning of the film. And then he plays an old man at the end. So, I mean, just if he would have acted in it, that would have been really cool, but he wrote, directed, and acted, and had no experience in movies. One of the documentaries I watched, this woman was talking about how she had to work with him and teach him what the different shots were. This is a long shot. This is a close shot. This is a fade in. Like, he knew nothing when he went to Hollywood. Nothing.
About film.
That's
he knew
amazing.
A lot about radio, but not
about film. But not
okay.
film.
Okay. So Thiel says... Before directing Citizen Kane, Welles produced The Invasion from Mars, the famous radio broadcast of H.G. Welles' War of Two Worlds. Now, Thiel's writing this for people who don't know this history. You know, it's many, 50 years later. And possibly the single most effective use of radio as a medium to achieve an effect. The panic in the streets which followed is well known, and even recently when it was replayed in Canada, it resulted in a minor rash of phone calls in some maritime communities inquiring as to the reality of the invasion. That radio broadcast wove together four different areas: traditions of the theater, the new medium of radio, hence sound, the traditions of literature, and its translation to theater, and the rising significance of science fiction. When Welles moved from radio to film to produce Citizen Kane, he was still enmeshed in the relation of the new society and its media. He hardly abandoned the theater, for the theatricality of large portions of the film aids it in achieving the mock grandiosity that is an essential part of its structure. He's talking about Citizen Kane. Yet he married film and theater to an examination of the life of a newspaper baron. So, you know, there's the mixed media, a life that the film presents through the very act of a journalist carrying out research for a story. This action, therefore, involves the clash that had developed by the 30s between the then relatively new Picture magazine and film newsreel and the older daily press of which Kane had been king. In executing his work, Welles weaves into his film not only the stage, the press, the documentary newsreel, the new and the old journalism, but the comic strip and the front page, the techniques of radio and the art of the graphic. It was André Bazin who first called attention to Welles' superb use of sound as a central component in his filmmaking, a component which he had learned to use in adapting drama to radio in the Mercury Theater of the 30s. In addition, the influence of the cartoon strip is certainly evident in Citizen Kane, for, as the Penguin History of Comics suggests, Welles' use of angles for dramatic effect, overlapping dialogue, sudden cutting from one scene to another, inset effects with one scene superimposed on another, and the opening sequence with its advancing succession of shots of an old mansion echoed the work of the comic strip artist and created a new library of film cliches. Moreover, the old mansion also had its reference to the Gothic novels as well as their dramatic and cinematic equivalents. So what Thiel is doing here is showing that much of the multimedia in Finnegan's Wake, all these things are in Finnegan's Wake, he's saying is in Citizen Kane. So he's really saying Citizen is a Joycean here in doing Citizen Kane. So then Don writes, that Welles' work resulted in a very different kind of phenomenon in film history from what might have been expected. For Citizen Kane appealed to Godard, who developed a cinematic form closer to the complexities of James Joyce than the apparent surface simplicity of Welles' tale of a journalist baron. Welles' broadcast of the invasion from Mars employed a news documentary style of presentation, a mode that always had an appeal for Jean-Luc Godard, and certainly appears to have had an appeal for the youthful Welles. Godard, in fact, saw himself as someone who wished to be a journalist. Quoting Godard, "Actually, if I have a secret ambition, it is to be put in charge of the French newsreel services." See, that's what I guess Godard was brought up on as a kid. All my films have been reported.
And Orson Welles was the voice of the March on Time, or the March of Time.
Right. The newsreels, or the major ones.
Yes.
All my films have been reports on the state of the nation. They're all newsreel documents, treated in a personal manner, perhaps, but in terms of contemporary actuality. Godard made this statement when discussing his film Deux ou Trois Choses, qui je sais d'elle, a film which in part was about housing complexes. In justifying its inclusiveness, Godard went on to argue, quote, "During the course of the film, in its discontinuous course, that is, I want to include everything, sport, politics, even groceries." Now think of how all this is in Finnegan's Wake. "Everything can be put into a film. When people ask me why I talk or have my characters talk about Vietnam, about Jacques Anquetil, or about a woman who deceives her husband, I refer the questioner to his own newspaper. It's all there. It's all mixed up. This is why I'm so attracted by television. A televised newspaper made up of carefully prepared documentaries would be extraordinary, even more so if one could get editors to take turns at editing these televised newspapers." So that's Godard. Then Don Thiel says, "This conviction that everything can be put into a film," and McLuhan wrote later that the medium of movies is a great medium because it can contain all other media.
Mm-hmm.
So this conviction that everything can be put into a film appears to refine the earlier conceptions of the makers of collages, whether in words or objects or paint, that we have discussed with reference to the way the newspaper reflected the modern city world and participated in shaping a new sensibility. But much of it was implicit in Welles, for his Citizen Kane is about the power of the newspaper and the way in which the newspaper emerges with the growing myth of the power-mad man, a type similar to the fascist dictators, as well as the product of the star concept that rose out of the media world of the 20s and 30s. So you have these dictators rising in the 30s, and they're riding on radio. And Welles is going to talk about the older kind of dictator, the newspaper owner or publisher. So they're all Papa's appears is the way Thunder 8, I think it is, Thunder 7 or 8 in Finney's Wake. Big Papa appears in the 20s and 30s due to newspaper electrified with the telegraph and radio and movies. In his film, Orson Welles develops a dialectic between different modes of information and storytelling. There's the press mode, the documentary film newsreel, and the actual making of a film. And plus, I would add, the journalist doing the story. Did you notice all that going on?
Oh, yeah.
The different mm-hmm. media?
Yep.
Here's my
answer. And then the journalist.
Oh.
Yeah, go ahead, journalist. Too. What about the journalist?
I was going to say he was the narrator. Like, you really didn't know who he was. He was just going around asking everything. He was trying to find out who Rosebud was.
He's the information hunter, which is what everybody is. He's HCE. Here comes everybody. Everybody's an information hunter by the time you get into the electric world of radio and movies and TV and telephone. And so that is the anonymous everybody. He's got a figure job of as a journalist, but it's actually what everybody's doing. They're becoming information mm-hmm. hunters. That's what McClone explains later. So what were we going to say, Carol?
Yeah, I think when Welles had his 2 years trying to figure out what to do, he was just realizing his trajectory of turning Broadway theater into radio, and then being taken to Hollywood. I mean, that's the whole hubris of people saying, oh, he's a star on radio, so he should be a star in movies, and they don't know that there's you have to translate yourself into a whole new media.
Right, because they're just looking at the content and the glamour of success.
Right,
so
then the 2 years he spent trying to figure out how to do it, and I think then he realized, oh, I can look at the media aspect of the movies and comment on it as I'm doing this film.
Yeah, and so the actual act of researching the different media that Welles would have done is the hidden ground of the movie Citizen Kane, because the voice can be Orson Welles researching the whole thing. So it's really a documentary about a research.
It's especially interesting, too, because in the movie RKO 281, where it's supposed to be about Orson making the movie, there's a scene where he's at San Simeon and Hearst accuses him of being just another actor. He looks at him and says, you're not an artist. You don't understand all this stuff. You're just another actor. You can't do it. So it was exactly what you said, Carolyn. If that movie is accurate, I mean, who knows what really happened? It's just everybody commenting. But it was Hearst accusing him of his own hubris, from which I'm sure he was suffering, that made him go after him, that made Orson go after William. Incidentally, Rosebud evidently was Hearst's name for Marion Davis, his lover's vagina.
Really? That's an inside thing. Who discovers that?
I know it was in a lot of the stuff that I looked at, a lot of the more documentary-ish stuff.
Yeah, so, Carolyn, the Rosebud was the name of Citizen Kane's sled. You know, that was his youthful mm-hmm. neurosis that made him have a fetish or something. So it turns out it was the name or some...
A different kind of sled.
Yeah, sliding.
It was...
Vagina walls.
Yeah, it was.
It was called Rosebud by Hearst about Marion Davies.
Right.
Right.
And
is Marion Davies an actress?
She was. She wanted to be like a Lucille Ball and do comedic stuff, but Hearst wanted her to be a serious dramatic actress, so she was terrible at it. So she was very popular. Everybody loved her. So the way that Orson made the girlfriend of Citizen Kane in the movie was very cruel. Evidently, Marion Davies really wasn't like that. And she did stay with Hearst all through his life, was with him when he died. And when he ran out of money, she sold a bunch of stuff that he had given her and scraped together $1 million for him and gave it to him just to keep him going at the end. Because, see, he was starting to lose his entire fortune right around the time that Citizen Kane came out.
Oh, is that right? So how come it's still going? The Hearst fortune still went on?
Well, he had tons of stuff. He bought all kinds of art. and they could liquidate it. But over time, I mean, when you're selling a silver tea set for $35,000 in 1941, it might take a little while for a buyer. He wasn't very liquid. He poured all of his fortune into art and antiques,
right?
Which were all crated up in citizen pain, crates of stuff that he never enjoyed.
So would Hearst know that the punchline would be Rosebud? Would he know the whole? Did the movie get made and then Hearst press it? So he'd be outraged at Wells using the term Rosebud, right? He would know what.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So where were we at? So Carolyn, you were going to say something?
But she was right about Orson's, his pride and whether he could actually go to Hollywood and do it, and discovering his trajectory and then finally deciding to be a magician with the media. Oh, forgot to mention, he also evidently studied magic with Houdini. And so he was really into magic. I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
And then the title of Paul's book is The Medium and the Magician. However, I don't think he quite got the whole, I don't think he gets it. He just picked up on the medium is and used that because Marshall does. I wouldn't read his whole book, and he's charging $80 for it. So I'm not reading it.
Okay. So you're reading excerpts online?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just some articles.
Right. By Paul Heyer.
Like my own, and I just wanted to see what had been written. I like my own conclusions better. I mean, in the end, I really do think that and there was something that I read somewhere, or saw in one of the documentaries, where when Orson decides to go after William, he literally says the movie can crush the paper in kind of a rock, scissors, paper kind of a way.
Yeah.
And he didn't really understand how much power. There was a certain naivete. He didn't understand the power that Hearst had. He didn't understand why everybody was so afraid of him. So had he not been so young, he might not have done this. But I think there was something important archetypally that went on with this battle. And I do think that it was the android meme, whatever you want to call it. I mean, not literally, because we weren't there yet.
No, android meme is later. But don't bring the android meme in yet.
I know. I know, but you know how when you say the
No, we will not tolerate the use of the term in this discussion. It's about the 30s and 40s, just not android memeing.
Okay, well, then we don't have to say that, but I feel like these media came to life, and there needed to be a battle.
No, that was the analog phase. They electric media were organic. They were basically alive. The android meme is the later replay of the dead organic analog media.
Well, what would you say about this then? That it's just two guys? That there's no larger thing going on where these...
Oh yeah, there's larger environments. There's larger media environments. Remember, there's no media in
the...
Listen, in the android meme, there are no media. Everything's digitally intertwined in a circuitry. There's no particular film. There's no radio. There's no TV. There's no book. There's no newspaper. That's pre-digital. Mm-hmm. That's what we call analog media. So McLuhan's Broadway play of different media battling out is sort of what you're getting at. And
that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the pre-android meme version of that would be.
Well, that's McLuhan. He just would have each medium stating what it had done. For example, here's Don Thiel is explaining how not just James Joyce, but many artists in many fields were picking up on the new theme of collage and montage. McLuhan wrote later that if you want to do art in the 20th century, it has to be collage. There are now rules in being a puny little artist. You must do collage. Otherwise, you're a rearview mirror, 19th century, nothing, with visual perspective and stuff, and nature romanticism, or still life. You've got to do collage. And Thiel is showing how collage was happening all across the great arts by great artists, like Joyce, like Orson Welles. So he says here, This conviction that everything can be put into a film appears to refine the earlier conceptions of the makers of collages, whether in words or objects or paint, that we have discussed with reference to the way the newspaper reflected the modern city world and participated in shaping a new sensibility. So the modern city was a world of collage, but much of it was implicit in Wells, where Citizen Kane is about the power of the newspaper and the way in which the newspaper emerges with the growing myth of the power mad man, a type similar to the fascist dictators, as well as the product of the star concept that rose out of the media world of the 20s and 30s. In his film, Wells develops a dialectic between different modes of information and storytelling, and this is what you're talking about. You're calling it the Android meme. The press, the documentary film newsreel, and the actual making of a film, and the researcher of the journalist, the voice. I'd add that part, the journalist.
But then, Bob, you, when you look at the documentarians, if you look at Orson Welles, I don't know anything about him, but he probably had an abusive father, and when he met up with, what's his name?
Randolph Hearst.
Hearst, and then he just put his father's image on Hearst's face and attacked him.
But we heard earlier Katie saying that the father encouraged Orson to be a genius. And was
it? But he was also a drunk. He was also a drunk, and he would travel with Orson, and he would get drunk and embarrass him in the evening.
Oh, okay. So there's an issue, yeah. So Carolyn's right on that point.
Mm-hmm. Right. Katie, I'm reading a new biography on James Joyce now, and it is bizarre how it's like every line, every character, everything and anything James Joyce has written, this biographer says, well, it's because of this person or that person or this association and that story. And
in Joyce's life.
In Joyce's life with all his family and friends and relations. So it makes you wonder, well, is all art biographical?
Well, that's what McLuhan says in the famous Playboy interview. He learned, he said, I realized that all art is personal experience. Now, that's content art, Carolyn, not media dynamics.
It's content art, so it's only someone like McLuhan and then Bob who can actually have an original thought.
Well, we do. Well, Ian says, I've never had an original thought. I create original environments. But this would be Gurdjieff's subjective art, is what we were just saying, personal experience. Objective art is knowing media magic and knowing the effects of your environments you're creating. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't be limited to being just a subjective artist or writer.
Right.
So Thiel says, it is significant that the... Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think Orson had the ability to be a media magician. He definitely had that talent, but I do think his art was personal. I think he had both.
Yeah, he made subjective art and noticed the new environment a little bit, of the new environment, but not the way Joyce did, I would say. So, you know, like Joyce, Finney's Wake is maybe an objective art. You know, Gurdjieff used to say the pyramids were objective art. But Finney's Wake is so hard, impossible to read. It's not what people think it is. So it's like invisible, like objective art. So Thiel says, it is significant that the quest for the truth, in quotes, truth of the life of Citizen Kane, is made by a News of the Week film journalist and not a print journalist, such as Kane himself had been. See? So it's like Wells is a film journalist. You get this, Carolyn?
Yeah.
Pay attention to this. My theme that Wells, the narrator is Wells himself, the film journalist. That's what Wells is doing. And he had to do this research like a journalist for a couple of years. And he's going after a print journalist, Kane.
Okay, so he's put another layer of media into himself.
Yeah, the hidden. And in that sense, it's about Wells' personal experience as a researcher.
Right.
So Thiel then says, among other effects, this fact of the film journalist places the whole film in a quasi-documentary frame, lending a credibility and veracity to the way the camera shapes the story. Using the newspaper world as a focus, or maybe a figure, the camera employs the collage method of the press itself, as well as the collage method of the film journalist, for the output of the press becomes an object filled with significance in the film, just as the quest of the film ultimately vitiates another object with significance, the sleigh that was Rosebud. though the ultimate irony is that the world of journalism, print or film, fails to realize the significance of such a trivial object in the life of Citizen Kane. The telling of the Kane story is segmented and discontinuous, is marked by a use of camera and sound that is central to its achievement. The camera, among other things, achieves effects of grandiosity and megalomania, which provide a kind of silent counterpoint to the very different use of such effects in the documentary propagandistic film by Leni Riefenstahl, whose Triumph of the Will was a profoundly important film event of the 30s. And I made a comment on Facebook about Roxy's videos of me and what we're doing, and I say that Roxy is a holopathic replay of Leni Riefenstahl. I mean, they're both in Berlin. So we have a new kind of propaganda about Dobbstown being made by the clever Mexican princess who they don't even notice is a propagandist until we admitted it. But that's another story for another hour of this endless show. Okay, so then Thiel says, but even in the focus on the megalomaniacal hero figure who appeals to the modern everyman as a result of the propagandistic nature of the present film, Wells' work has its connection with Joyce's dream satire, Finnegan's Wake, in his everyman, who is a megalomaniacal way in who the everyman, everybody under electric conditions is now a king or queen, who in a megalomaniacal way tends to see his life in the mythic dimensions of the history of his country and the history of the world. So the megalomania of Hearst controlling the United States was mimed in Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. At least that was the dream of every man, because it was possible, but you only got occasional dictators pulling it off. Both works, Citizen Kane and Finnegan's Wake, using different methods and perspectives, are attempting to develop a new perception of the world that has influenced the way in which every man attends to the stories which are told to him. So he's saying Joyce and Wells are trying to show that the consumer of information has been changed over the last 30 years back then. You know what I mean? And he has a different kind of story he requires. The root of the dilemma created by the use of certain techniques leads back again to Bertolt Brecht and the critic Walter Benjamin. And interestingly enough, to the fact that the early dramatically oriented Wells was very interested in Bertolt Brecht's work. Now, I think that's about it for now. And he goes into Brecht and Moholy Nagy and other artists to show the intertwining of the concerns of the avant-garde thinkers of that day and artists. The avant-garde overlay, which included Orson Welles, the young Orson Welles.
Mm-hmm. One other point is some people that I read...
I will say this, Kate. If you notice in the Ted Carpenter speech, which was an excellent speech, everybody should listen to that 100 times, he says that Joyce and Pound and Citizen Kane and these guys were natural products of the media environment of the 20s and 30s. And it is that awareness that McLuhan is an expert on. The genetic effects, the mimic effects of a new environment. In other words, when you bring in TV in the 50s, you get Elvis. Inevitably, you'll get an Elvis. Let's see if that's Corbin calling. Yep, there's Corbin calling. Let me just see if I don't know if I can hear him. Hello, Corbin. What's your problem, Corbin, or what's your solution?
You want to put on speaker?
Excellent job. Can I call back in on the other phone so I can speak with for a minute?
Well, yeah, and in 15, 20 minutes, I don't know. Why do you leave so early? Why don't you show up in 5 hours and call in?
I can call back in a few hours, but right now you're on a tangent, you're on a pull, you know.
Yeah, so why are you calling? We're busy right now. It's not your turn.
No.
What, you think you have priority over everybody else?
No, not at all. I've waited, and I just...
Yeah, everybody else is waiting, too.
Katie's done an excellent job. There's two questions I have, I'm asking right now. Number one, the Orson Welles, the radio show. It was the what anniversary this year. It was all over NPR. Basically, it was Pacifica Radio. It was before Pacifica Radio was actually Pacifica Radio. It was broadcast in New York City. And nonetheless, I met Orson in 81. At that time, he was very desperate for a gig. He was a big man. He had a chef show at that point, somewhere down in West Palm or something. I met him in Miami.
Yeah.
We were trying to put together a project where he had done the voiceover for the search for the Titanic, okay? So all these things tie in together, and I wanted to have a little interaction for a minute or so, and it's, Katie's done an excellent job, but number one, let's get, what's the anniversary of the radio show? I'm counting, this is 70 years since it first broadcast.
It'd be 76, 38, and 76 years later is 2014.
Yeah, so how many?
So maybe last year was the 75th anniversary.
Yeah, it must have been last year. 75 is a good number. They probably did it last year. 75th anniversary.
No, it was this year of April. It was broadcast April what?
38.
April of 38. So, yeah, they put it this year, they put it Pacifica Radio saying basically, understand, that was the only medium that people had.
Yeah.
Joe Desert was out in the desert, and even in New York City that was considered civilized, essentially they're saying that they're coming down 42nd Street. The Bronx has been taken over any minute now. I can hear them. Wait. And it was so brilliant with what they were working with.
But we know all this. Okay, Corbin, we'll see. We'll get you back in there a little later. You're not making any new statement. We'd like to hear more about what you thought of him when you met him, but just hold a little while. Okay, thank you for your input. Please don't call here again. Please call on the air. Please do not call my home. I am busy doing a radio show. I'm such a nice guy. I let you on my personal phone here. How you got my number, I'll never know. Yeah, you said that. Katie actually did only a mediocre job. He's not given time to do a great job. So let's just stop the compliments. It's bullshit. Okay, we hung him up. Okay, don't take that personally, Katie.
That's
it's just
so
a technical
cool,
comment.
Oh, I don't care.
What?
Yeah.
So you don't even care.
I loved it. I don't care what anybody thinks. I had so much fun.
That's the attitude.
I don't
even
care.
You must rehearse that. You must not be concerned about the reaction to how you're performing. And we do it by saying you're doing shit. You're doing fucking shit. Everybody's bored.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even Ion was here for a while. Ion even left. Ion got bored and left. We don't know if they ever come back. But
they can just turn to another station.
Yes, that's right. Well, I enjoy the you are the first post Ionette. I have not heard anybody ask me what the hell that means, but they're not inclined to know what anything means, so it remains.
I don't think it means anything. It's just some piece of bullshit that you said about me so that I wouldn't quit.
Not true. Not true at all. You're not going to quit. Okay, so
cool.
The...
starting to have fun.
Yeah, so where are we at now, Carolyn? We've... yes, you were saying something?
In.
Yes, a very good point. Is Ruth still there? Yes, we're going to bring Ruth in very quickly, and... then hopefully Ion will come in and give a new private session to Ruth right in front of us. But, yes, Carolyn, you're saying something, Carolyn?
No, I'm in agreement. Ruth is next on the agenda.
Yes, and Katie's done a wonderful job, quoting Corbin, analyzing the hell out of what we were both doing at the same time earlier this week.
Awesome.
I was trying to show to understand that McLuhan is not identifying with any of these cultural works. He is saying humanity doesn't realize that we have a new key to the creative process. You bring in a certain medium, you will get, in a literate society, a reaction, which is all the popular feds and heroes and stars that came were acting out robotically, like somnambulists, inevitable effects that a super genius could have foreseen. McLuhan being the genius in retrospect, James Joyce may be being close to what was coming, but Don Thiel is trying to show the hidden ground for all the arts before McLuhan showed up. All right?
Okay, so, and I'm so glad that you said that, because that is what, when I was saying the stuff that was incorrect about the Android meme, what you just said, thought was the newspaper coming to life through a man and the movie coming to life through a man and them going to battle. It wasn't that at all. It was just the inevitability of when a medium is
When you have a literate industrial, when you have a literate, and like when you took radio and put into Africa, you don't get a power mad maniac like Hearst who's collecting art. See, that's a literate, industrial, visually biased, money control person. Money is the medium of exchange. So money goes nuts in the moneyed societies, in the literate societies, in the printing press societies. It goes nuts in the 20s and ends up crashing. What happens in Africa when you bring radio in the 50s and 60s, you get tribal warfare. Now, you have a kind of tribal warfare by the 40s because people have been radio massaged for 20 years, even in the literate West. So that tribal warfare becomes World War II, but it took 20 years for that to happen. In Africa, the tribal warfare begins immediately, and it's a different dynamic than a power-mad individual, which comes out of the 19th century literate wealth world of robber barons. You see, different cultures have different reactions to a medium. And that's what's interesting. That's what one should analyze. One doesn't need to go to a museum or a gallery or anything that's supposed to be culture. Look at Baudrillard. He says, I'm not interested in culture. We here in INDB are not interested in any cultural content. We are looking at the dynamics of form, but especially the effects of the new form of ion on everything. That's how we're updating Don Thiel and McLuhan. We're looking at the effects of an environment that nobody even notices yet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what's avant-garde about this theater we're presenting here today. So we look at the previous environments and what they did to give us clues to how to look at what ION's doing. All right? So that's what you're helping do. That's what you're helping do by taking interest in reading up on this stuff, following your labyrinth of your mind's bliss about these topics, which are the only interesting topics for the mind to look at, because content arguments are boring about what do you like or don't like or why you think this is pretty or that's not pretty. That's boring. We're talking about why whole societies get obsolesced as a human species when you bring in the Internet.